Welcome to the Audio Digest of the American Journal of Psychiatry. This is Dr. Susan Schultz with highlights for November 2012. These include a review of how ketamine creates its rapid antidepressant effect. Clinical articles include a treatment in psychiatry feature on skin picking disorder. Several studies focus on children. One looks at IQ and behavioral problems in children of mothers who took antidepressants during pregnancy. It compares them with children whose mothers were depressed but untreated, and with children of non-depressed mothers. A long-term follow-up studied psychopathology in adolescent offspring of parents with panic disorder or depression. Another longitudinal study examined the continuity of psychiatric disorders between ages 3 and 6. This article's been selected as meriting CME for readers who subscribe to the AJP CME course program. Each month, brief companion exams are created for 3 articles from the issue. By reading the articles and completing the online exam, individuals can earn up to 1 AMA PRA Category 1 credit per article. This activity is sponsored by the American Psychiatric Association. To subscribe, click on the CME link at our homepage, ajp.psychiatryonline.org. This month, our treatment in psychiatry features about skin picking disorder. Prevalence studies have shown rates from 1 to 5%, but it's not explicitly listed in DSM-4. John Grant and colleagues review its characteristics and present treatment guidelines. A proposed set of diagnostic criteria include recurrent skin picking that results in lesions, repeated attempts to decrease or stop the behavior, and clinically significant distress or impairment in functioning. Substance use and other medical conditions have to be ruled out. Age at onset varies from childhood to middle age. Skin picking disorder can occur with a variety of other conditions, such as depression and substance use problems, but it generally begins earlier than the co-occurring disorders. Many individuals with skin picking disorder report that the picking takes up several hours a day. They miss work, school, or social activities. There can be multiple triggers, including stress, anxiety, boredom, fatigue, or anger. Emotion regulation difficulties and emotion reactivity have been shown to predict picking behavior. Patients report being aware of the behavior most of the time, but in many cases, it becomes conscious only when someone else brings it to their attention or a picking site begins to bleed. Pathological skin picking is often misdiagnosed as obsessive-compulsive disorder, but several lines of evidence suggest that it's distinct. Individuals with skin picking disorder are more likely to be female than those with OCD. They're more likely to have other grooming disorders, and they're more likely to have first-degree relatives with grooming disorders. Neurocognitive tests also show differences, such as worse motor inhibition in individuals with skin picking disorder. Other grooming disorders, such as trichotillomania, are common in individuals with skin picking disorder. Neurocognitive data suggest differences, however. In a comparison, patients with skin picking disorder had worse stop signal reaction times than healthy comparison subjects. Subjects with trichotillomania had times that were intermediate between those of the comparison subjects and the individuals with skin picking disorder. For many people, skin picking disorder begins at the onset of a dermatological condition, such as acne, but the picking continues even after the original condition clears up. The face is the most commonly reported site, but other areas are also common. In one study, the respondents reported having an average of 4 to 5 sites. The number of lesions varies widely, though, and may exceed 100. The picking can result in significant tissue damage. It often leads to medical complications, such as localized infections and septicemia. Patients are often too ashamed to report areas that have become infected. a thorough physical exam is often needed to evaluate the extent and severity of the picking. Topical or oral antibiotics may be needed. Severe cases have even led to skin grafting, epidural abscess, or paralysis. The existing family history data suggests that skin picking disorder is familial. A genetic influence is indicated by a twin study in which the concordance of clinically significant skin picking was greater for monozygotic than for dizygotic twins. Individuals with skin picking disorder rarely seek dermatological or psychiatric treatment. Many avoid treatment because of social embarrassment. Others think their condition is just a bad habit or untreatable. For a patient who does seek treatment, the clinical evaluation entails both physical and psychiatric components. The physical exam has two goals. First, to evaluate the extent of the picking and develop appropriate interventions. For example, does the person need antibiotics? Has a more systemic illness resulted from the picking, such as bacteremia, cellulitis, or joint infection? The second purpose is to check for possible dermatological or infectious etiologies. There are many possibilities. Just a few of them are scabies, atopic dermatitis, psoriasis, and blistering skin disorders. Patients should be sent for a thorough evaluation from a dermatologist with knowledge about skin picking disorder. A thorough psychiatric evaluation is required to identify co-occurring disorders and their relationship to skin picking. For example, does the person exhibit social anxiety as a result of the picking, or are they independent? In addition, substance use and current medication should be determined. Skin picking may develop as a result of cocaine or methamphetamine use, or may be secondary to stimulant medications used for attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. In children, the exam should also focus on the possibility that the skin picking is related to a pervasive developmental disorder. It may also be related to Prader-Willi syndrome, a rare genetic disorder that's often associated with hyperphagia, hypogonadism, and frequent skin picking. Patients should be given information about the disorder, including possible etiologies and the risks and benefits of treatment. Research on treatment has largely focused on cognitive behavioral interventions and pharmacology. Psychosocial treatments include habit reversal and acceptance-enhanced behavior therapy. Data on the efficacy of serotonin reuptake inhibitors have been mixed. Some studies have shown improvement in certain aspects of picking behavior. The anticonvulsant lamotrigine has also been investigated. An open-label study demonstrated some benefit for skin picking disorder, but a double-blind, placebo-controlled study did not. Opioid antagonists reduce self-licking or self-chewing in the majority of dogs with an animal model of this condition. In humans, the efficacy of opioid antagonists is supported only by case reports. Likewise, glutamatergic agents have shown early promise in case reports. One example is N-acetylcysteine, which has been beneficial for skin picking disorder, trichotillomania, and nail biting. The psychiatric team should collaborate with other medical care providers to monitor the patient and provide rapid intervention if serious medical sequelae result from the skin picking. Next up is the review article on ketamine. A single dose produces a rapid antidepressant response in patients with major depressive disorder, and the effects last up to 2 weeks. Understanding the mechanisms that mediate the behavioral effects could uncover novel avenues for developing fast-acting antidepressants. Eggy Cavallali and Lisa Monteja discuss recent findings on how ketamine works. From there, they explore the possible molecular strategies to help uncover novel ways to develop fast-acting antidepressants. Ketamine is an antagonist of NMDA receptors, a subgroup of glutamate receptors. Despite ketamine's efficacy, widespread use is curtailed by its potential to be abused and to produce psychotic-like effects. The duration of the antidepressant response for 1 to 2 weeks indicates a key role of neuronal plasticities. In animal models, acute ketamine administration has been shown to activate several downstream signaling cascades. Observations point to a specific role of NMDA receptor blockade on subsequent synaptic signaling and to mediation of rapid antidepressant-like effects that can't be mimicked by other means of altering postsynaptic glutamatergic responses. Studies have dissected the process of neurotransmitter release into molecular and functional components. These studies have also uncovered clear mechanistic distinctions between evoked neurotransmission and spontaneous neurotransmission. Evoked transmission is the rapid release of a neurotransmitter that's coupled to neuronal activity. Spontaneous release occurs independently of neuronal activity and is less commonly studied. It's a specific regulator of postsynaptic sensitivity to neurotransmitters because it suppresses dendritic protein translation locally and maintains receptor composition of synapses. Also, when glutamate is released spontaneously, it activates specific NMDA receptors that couple to an intracellular signaling cascade. These signals mediate cellular and molecular processes in a manner that's distinct from when glutamate's released through evoked transmission. Ketamine and other NMDA receptor antagonists create fast antidepressant-like effects in mouse behavioral models. The effects depend on rapid protein synthesis of brain-derived neurotrophic factor, or BDNF. Previous studies have linked BDNF to traditional antidepressant action, and its expression in the hippocampus is increased by antidepressants. Rapid production of BDNF, in turn, requires deactivation of an enzyme that affects protein synthesis. This enzyme is called eukaryotic elongation factor 2, or EF2 kinase. Ketamine blockade of NMDA receptors at rest deactivates the enzyme, resulting in desuppression of BDNF synthesis. These effects are not mimicked by altering neuronal activity levels in vivo, so it appears that only spontaneous glutamate release leads to ketamine's action. Research has also shown that inhibitors of EF2 kinase trigger fast-acting antidepressant-like effects in mice. In principle, these mechanisms should be present in several types of glutamatergic synapses in the CNS. However, the work so far indicates that ketamine-induced dephosphorylation of EF2 is most detectable in the hippocampus. The effect of an NMDA receptor blocker such as ketamine on spontaneous neurotransmission appears to be necessary and sufficient to elicit the behavioral antidepressant effect. However, it affects both spontaneous and evoked transmission. NMDA receptor activation during evoked neurotransmission is well characterized. Its pathway underlies several forms of long-term synaptic plasticity, and its inhibition triggers several cognitive side effects of NMDA receptor blockers. So it's possible that simply developing other NMDA receptor blockers may not be enough to avoid the side effects associated with blocking evoked transmission. Indeed, it's possible that the adverse psychotic-like effects from higher doses of ketamine may be due to a more pronounced effect on evoked neurotransmission. To circumvent these problems, an upstream strategy that selectively suppresses spontaneous neurotransmitter release may have several advantages. One possible selective approach may take advantage of the differences in presynaptic vesicles involved in the two forms of neurotransmission. A number of studies have indicated that the presynaptic vesicle populations giving rise to these events are distinct. recent work has uncovered several molecular candidates that may be involved in this dichotomy. The findings suggest a novel and intriguing target for the development of fast-acting antidepressants and possibly compounds that are effective against other neuropsychiatric disorders. Now we'll take a look at psychiatric disorders in young children. There's a lot of skepticism regarding the validity of psychiatric diagnoses in preschoolers. The existing symptom scales are generally based on measures for older children and adults, and there's a widespread belief that young children will grow out of their problems. Longitudinal studies are among the principal means of evaluating the validity of psychiatric diagnoses. Sarah Bufford and colleagues compared diagnoses in a group of children at ages 3 and 6. They used a comprehensive diagnostic interview designed for this population. Commercial mailing lists were used to recruit families with 3-year-old children. Children with significant medical or developmental disorders were excluded. The parent, who served as primary caretaker, was interviewed regarding the 3-year-old child. For more than 400 children, the parent was interviewed again when the child was 6 years old. The instrument used at both times was the preschool age psychiatric assessment. The interviewers at age 6 were blind to the results of the interviews at age 3. At both times, about a quarter of the children met criteria for a diagnosis. Half the children who met criteria for a diagnosis at age 3 met the criteria for the same or different diagnosis at age 6. And about half of those who met criteria for a diagnosis at age 6 had met criteria for a diagnosis at age 3. Overall, the children who received a diagnosis at age 3 were nearly 5 times as likely as other children to get a diagnosis at age 6. The rates of most disorders were similar at the 2 interviews. There were significant increases in the rates of depression and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, and a decrease in generalized anxiety disorder. Only 6 children received a diagnosis of depression at age 3, and the increase may reflect a greater ability of 6-year-olds to vocalize distress. It might also reflect an actual change in the rate of depression, since as children begin school, they face greater performance demands. The increase in the rate of ADHD may reflect greater recognition of it as children enter formal schooling. The reason for the decrease in generalized anxiety disorder isn't clear. It's possible that the inquisitive nature of younger children is perceived as worrying by some parents. 2 types of continuity were examined. 1 was homotypic continuity, the persistence of the same disorder. There was significant homotypic continuity between ages 3 and 6 for ADHD, oppositional defiant disorder, and 5 individual anxiety disorders. Homotypic continuity didn't differ by sex. Heterotypic continuity is the existence of different diagnoses at 2 time points. In these children, depression and anxiety disorders at age 3 each predicted the other at age 6. In addition, ADHD and oppositional defiant disorder at age 3 each predicted the other at age 6. However, the results for some of these relationships were attenuated somewhat when age 3 comorbidity was controlled for. Agoraphobia at age 3 was associated with multiple diagnoses at age 6. The next study also evaluated young children. They were the children of women who had taken antidepressants during pregnancy and children of women who stopped taking antidepressants before pregnancy. Both groups were compared with the children of healthy, non-depressed women. Antidepressants are known to cross the human placenta, and thus they may interfere with fetal brain development. On the other hand, untreated maternal depression itself is also related to adverse outcomes. The effects on child neurodevelopment of taking neurotransmitter reuptake inhibitors during pregnancy hasn't been adequately studied. So Irina Newellman and colleagues did a prospective study of more than 200 women and their children to separate the effects of antidepressants from the effects of depression. There were four groups of women. The first group took venlafaxine, a combined norepinephrine and serotonin reuptake inhibitor. The second group took serotonin reuptake inhibitors, or SSRIs, during pregnancy. The third group of women were depressed but stopped taking antidepressants before pregnancy. And the fourth group consisted of women who were not depressed and didn't take antidepressants during pregnancy. All of the groups were recruited from women who contacted a prenatal care program. During pregnancy, data on medical, genetic, and obstetric histories was collected. Information about pregnancy and the perinatal and postnatal periods was determined from a follow-up phone call several months after delivery. The children were evaluated at one time point between the ages of 3 and 6 years. The mother's depression severity was measured at multiple times. During pregnancy and in each depressive episode after delivery, it was rated with a visual analog scale. At the time the child was tested, maternal depressive symptoms were evaluated with the Center for Epidemiologic Studies depression scale. Of the women in the two groups taking medication during pregnancy, about two-thirds took antidepressants throughout pregnancy. The dose and duration of medication were included in the analyses. The children were given tests of IQ and behavioral outcomes. Full-scale verbal and performance IQs were measured with the Wechsler Preschool and Primary Scale of Intelligence. Behavior was evaluated with the Child Behavior Checklist and the Connors Parent Rating Scale. Both of these were completed by the mother. The Child Behavior Checklist provides scores on internalizing problems, such as depressed affect and withdrawn behaviors, and externalizing problems, such as aggressive and delinquent behaviors. It also includes a total score. The Connors Parent Rating Scale's Global Index and DSM-IV Total Symptom Subscale were used to evaluate ADHD and other DSM-IV symptoms. The children from the four groups did not differ in gestational age or birth weight. The children of the non-depressed women encountered fewer neonatal complications, but the difference wasn't statistically significant. All children had similar anthropometric measurements. The children of mothers in the venlafaxine and SSRI groups did not differ significantly from children of mothers with untreated depression in any of the IQ or behavioral measures. The children of the healthy women had higher IQs than those exposed to antidepressants, but all of the mean IQ measures were above 100 in all groups. Children with first trimester antidepressant exposure had IQ similar to those of children exposed throughout pregnancy. Children from all three groups exposed to maternal depression had numerically higher scores for problematic behavior than the children of the non-depressed women. However, the difference among groups was statistically significant for just one measure, the total problem subscale of the Connors Parent Rating Scale. Scores here were highest for the SSRI group and lowest for the children of the untreated depressed women. None of the cognitive or behavioral outcomes was correlated with the dose or duration of antidepressant treatment during pregnancy. Significant predictors for the child's IQ were maternal IQ and the child's sex. Girls had higher IQs than boys, which is consistent with other findings in this age range. A significant predictor for all behavior outcomes was the severity of maternal depression during pregnancy, at the time of the child's testing, or at both times. Among the children exposed to antidepressants, 11% received a diagnosis of poor neonatal adaptation signs. The IQ measures of these children didn't differ from those of the other children exposed to antidepressants. However, clinically significant behavior problems were twice as common in those with poor neonatal adaptation signs as in the other children exposed to antidepressants. The editorial by Meyer Steiner summarizes the data on the safety of antidepressants for pregnant women. Whether antidepressant use during pregnancy is better or worse for the offspring than untreated maternal depression is still mostly unanswered. The majority of studies have focused on the risks of neonatal malformation and on immediate postpartum neonatal discontinuation syndrome, also known as neonatal adaptation syndrome. Monitoring these outcomes is based on retrospective case control surveillance, which has obvious limitations. The risk of major structural or genetic birth defects in the United States is approximately 3% of all births. To date, there's no report suggesting that using antidepressants during pregnancy increases that risk above the general population risk. There's also no evidence that antidepressants cause organ-specific defects. The only exception is the report suggesting that paroxetine use early in pregnancy is related to an increased risk of atrium septum defects. Several databases with larger cohorts have presented a more optimistic view when comparing the ill effects of untreated maternal depression to the outcomes for neonates born to mothers taking antidepressants during pregnancy. A large systematic review and meta-analysis showed statistically significant effects on gestational age, birth weight, and Apgar scores among infants exposed to antidepressants in utero. However, the effects were small, and the values in the exposed group typically fell within the normal range. Gestational age was approximately 3 days shorter in the exposed group, birth weight was 75 grams lower, and the difference in Apgar score was less than half a point. A handful of studies have examined the impact of antidepressant exposure during pregnancy on developmental milestones in the offspring. These include cognitive and behavioral functioning in preschoolers and long-term follow-up into adolescence and adulthood. None suggests any significant negative impact. On the other hand, there's ample evidence regarding anxiety, depression, and in particular stress during pregnancy, especially early in gestation. These conditions can have adverse effects on fetal maturation, cognitive performance during infancy, and learning and memory in 6 to 8 year old children. The study by Newman and colleagues is consistent with these findings. It failed to show an effect of antidepressant medication on children's intellectual or behavioral outcomes. Instead, the results showed that childhood exposure to maternal depression is associated with behavioral problems in the offspring. Regardless of this encouraging perspective, healthcare providers should keep in mind that in order to prescribe antidepressants during pregnancy, the indication must be compelling. Not only is it crucial to establish an Axis I diagnosis, it's also important to assess the pregnant woman's degree of distress and burden of illness. It's also paramount to have a frank discussion with her on the pros and cons of using antidepressants during pregnancy based on the most recent available evidence. Her consent must be obtained, and whenever possible, this should be done with her partner in attendance. We'll conclude with another article on patients' offspring. Dinah Hirschfeld-Becker and colleagues have been tracking outcomes for children of parents with panic disorder, major depression, or both. At baseline, the offspring ranged in age from 5 to 25. The first follow-up was done 5 years later. At that time, parental panic predicted a wide range of anxiety disorders in the offspring, while parental depression was related to a greater risk for depression and disruptive behavior disorders in the offspring. Now the results of the 10-year follow-up are available. The parents were originally recruited from clinical referrals and local advertisements. They were diagnosed according to DSM-3R. Comparison families were also located through ads. In these families, both parents were free of major anxiety and mood disorders. The diagnostic assessments of the children used current versions of the KSADS-E, the Schedule for Affective Disorders and Schizophrenia for School-Age Children, epidemiologic version. The follow-ups used an addition based on DSM-4 for participants under age 18. For those who are 18 or older, the structured clinical interview for DSM-4 was used and was supplemented with modules from the KSADS to evaluate childhood diagnoses. Interviews were conducted with the mothers for all of the offspring, and participants age 12 or older were also interviewed directly. A disorder was diagnosed if the DSM-4 criteria were met in either interview. Offspring from more than 100 families were evaluated at the 10-year follow-up. Among the offspring of the depressed parents, 45% had a lifetime history of depression. The rate was higher than the rate for the comparison group, both in the offspring of parents with depression only and in offspring of parents with comorbid panic disorder. But the offspring of parents with depression only had a significantly higher rate than those whose parents had both disorders or panic disorder alone. In addition, parental depression independently predicted bipolar, drug use, and disruptive behavior disorders in the offspring. Disruptive behavior disorders included ADHD, oppositional defiant disorder, and conduct disorder. Parental depression was not related to a greater risk for anxiety disorders in the offspring, except for specific phobia. Parental panic, independent of depression, predicted panic disorder, agoraphobia, social phobia, obsessive-compulsive disorder, and the presence of multiple anxiety disorders in the offspring. Parental panic did not increase the risk of depression in the offspring. Rates of specific phobia in offspring were higher in all three high-risk groups than in the comparison group, but the risk in the offspring of parents with panic plus depression wasn't significantly higher than the risk for offspring of parents with either disorder alone. The offspring of parents with panic disorder and/or depression had lower global ratings of functioning, and parental depression was also related to greater school dysfunction and psychiatric hospitalizations in the offspring. In addition, the high-risk offspring had earlier onset of disorders than comparison subjects, and they remained at risk for the onset of new disorders in adolescence. Fathers and mothers with panic disorder appeared to confer similar risks for anxiety disorders in the offspring, but there were some differences. Maternal panic disorder was associated with a higher risk for offspring social phobia, while paternal panic was associated with offspring OCD. Both maternal and paternal depression were associated with a greater risk for depression in the offspring. This concludes our audio highlights of the November issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry. Please visit our website, ajp.psychiatryonline.org, for the complete versions of these and other articles, including author affiliations and financial disclosures. We also welcome comments. They can be emailed to Jane Weaver. Her email address is jweaver@psychpsych.org. Next month, our topics will include ECT for refractory depression, L-methylfolate as adjunctive therapy for SSRI-resistant depression, white matter abnormalities in mild traumatic brain injury, and impaired semantic processing in patients with mild cognitive impairment. We hope that you'll join us. Thank you.